vivo qualitative data analysis software empowers researchers around the world to discover rich insights within their qualitative data. This podcast gives you unique insights into the methods, the processes, and the passions of researchers. Welcome to the InVivo podcast, Between the Data.
So thanks for joining us today. I'm Stacey Penna, the Marketing Partnership and Strategy Senior Director at Lumavero. Today's podcast is with colleagues Marla Rogers, Mixed Methods Research Manager and Specialist. And with her is Rachel Tang, Qualitative Research Manager. They both work at the Canadian Hub for Applied and Social Research at the University of Saskatchewan. Welcome, Marla and Rachel. Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
So first off, just, I was really intrigued when I went to the Canadian Hub for Applied and Social Research website. Can you describe what you do there or what the hub's all about?
The unit itself was established probably in that 2011-2012 academic year at the U of S. And back then we went by the Social Sciences Research Laboratories. And when it kind of kicked off, there was this really strong focus on kind of providing research infrastructure support. But then over the years, and especially through COVID and after COVID, we've relinquished a lot of the space and technological infrastructure and instead focused more on sort of like the staff expertise and some software and some platform resources. And then in 2020, we rebranded to the Canadian Hub of Applied and Social Research. And that was to kind of encapsulate the fact that we weren't really just serving the University of Saskatchewan faculty anymore. We really were taking on a lot of external clients. And so altogether, the unit consists of 8 research managers and specialists. We all have that manager and specialist title after our specialty. And just recently, we've really expanded and we've started to acquire assistant managers as well, just because there's been so much increase in the amount of work that we've been doing. And although I'd say that many of the staff within the unit have qualitative experience or know-how, Rachel and I are sort of like identified as a specialist, as it were. And so we do take on the bulk of the qualitative work that comes into the unit. So what that could be really ranges from anything just like taking on a portion of a study from, we all know that like faculty are super busy. So maybe they have grant money and are doing a project, but just don't have the hours to dedicate to something, so we can take that off their plate. Or in some cases, we assist faculty members who don't have a lot of qualitative experience and they're kind of like just getting a feel for the waters, as it were, in the qual world and just need that extra assistance. And then, yeah, like I said, we take on a lot of external contracts as well. So for me, I do a lot of interviewing and focus group facilitation for program and process evaluations. An external contract can be anything from faculty from other universities. We work with nonprofits, for-profit organizations, government. It's been really varied and really, really interesting. As the work itself, we're full service, but we're also a la carte. So in qualitative, we can do everything from consultation and design, data collection, coding and analysis, report writing, even manuscript support and authorships. And then for myself, there's also things like qualitative surveys or something in that realm as well.
So like, how do people find you?
A lot of it just comes through the website. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of word of mouth. Yeah. We have a lot of repeat clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I like that. It's sort of like a hybrid mm-hmm. university/like consulting service, right? For external. Yeah. So how does that differ from, a research department or center at a university?
Okay, so as far as I know, even within Canada, we're really unique as for what we do. So we operate on a cost recovery model, which is going to be different from a research department right away. Departments tend to have like faculty and graduate students, so like often serving maybe a single discipline or like adjacent disciplines. All our staff come with really various backgrounds. All our managers have master's or PhDs, and we specialize in methods rather than like a research topic. Hmm. Although we do tend to have sort of areas of expertise where we've garnered a lot of experience in, or if you did your PhD in an area, yes, you have expertise in that topic. And then my understanding for centers, like research support centers in other universities, is that their main objective would be to focus on kind of like grant support and fund management. And that's, we can help write a grant, but that's, we don't do any fund management. That's just not our department.
Sure. Well, great. Thank you for explaining all that. Cause like I said, I was really interested in it because it seemed like a unique model, like you just described. So, and that's why I found it interesting too, because when you shared your research with me, it seemed like it was a range of qualitative studies, right? And primarily focused on health, not all of them. But, you know, how do you decide who to work with and what topic that you choose? Or maybe you, I don't know how it works in the hub.
Yes, I can take this one. So that's really one of the, I mean, Marla can attest to this too. I think it's one of the challenges and most rewarding aspects of the job is that we have to kind of be prepared to support people across disciplines, whatever topic, you know, wheresoever there are humans, there is the potential for qualitative research. So it's very exciting and keeps it interesting, even though we might apply the same methodology, you know, we're doing it for different reasons or answering different research questions. A different audience is going to see the output. So typically we, at least for myself, we don't select people to work with. They usually come to us, as Marla was saying, because they don't have the time or the expertise to get it done. And since I started in the unit back in 2012, there really was a trend of an increasing demand for the need for support for qualitative research. There's not a lot of graduate or postgraduate training in it. So there was really a gap there. And yeah, so we really saw an uprise in qualitative research projects. And it's, I think, consistently been one of the more frequently applied methodologies and services that folks reach out to us for, whether it be transcription, analysis, data collection. So yeah, folks decide to work with us. And then, so topics are typically predetermined by the researchers. They've secured the grant money, and then they come to us for sort of that back-end support. Yeah, and then... trying to think if there's anything else where we might provide more input up front is, say, with the student population, maybe grad students or undergrads, or those finishing their dissertations, or during class presentations where we offer advice as to what kind of research questions are best answered by qualitative or mixed methods. Because sometimes folks really need their hand held and they're new to social research in general, even, and they're just not sure, like, what's the best way to approach this? This is one I want to discover, or this is who I want to speak to, but I'm not sure where to go from there. So really depending on how much of that really sticking with them from beginning to end that they need, that also kind of determines our level of engagement. So yeah. And then, you know, in that case, if we're talking to students or first time people, which we often are, we kind of tell them the work that we focus on in our unit tends to be evaluative, exploratory, those kinds of, you know, answering the how and the why, as opposed to just the what and how much, which is typically more quantitative based, though, you know, we see more of that in sort of the tools, which we'll talk about later, and, you know, qualitative analysis software, where you can count frequencies and where that becomes important. So yeah, I think that sums it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I mean, and then you also have your name on the papers too that you work with on.
Right.
So it's like a little bit more than a just a support, right? Because you're doing the research sort of with them, it seems. So you're not just supporting them, you're doing more than that. I mean, I guess it's both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we always start as sort of that service and that contract and agreement that we're service providers and they're paying, you know, or using their funds for that. But there definitely is always that potential and opportunity. And some folks really want to give us credit, especially, again, if we are there for both like the data collection and analysis, like the bigger the part we have in it. And some people just truly do understand how intensive the work is and they, you know, want to give credit where credit is due. So we definitely don't like impose that on folks, but it's been a huge unexpected pleasure of the job and unanticipated benefit that folks are willing to put us as co-authors.
That's great. So many of the studies that I read through are mixed methods. So what were your roles in those studies? Did you work primarily on the qualitative part or did you do a mix?
Okay, so you noticed in my title that I'm a mixed methods research manager. So I do work on both the qual and the quantitative strands in a mixed design. I actually started out in more quantitative methodologies when I graduated. And then I kind of moved more to that qual mixed approach in 2012. But for the quantitative side for supports of Chaser, we're pretty profoundly set up. Like, we have experimental and non-experimental surveys. We have computational research, social network analysis, GIS specialists. We used to have a telephone survey lab, which we actually recently decommissioned. So yeah, we're really well set up on that quant side. And for me, I will work on the non-experimental surveys. If it's anything else in those quantitative tools, we have our other staff that are more specialized in that area. So they'll take that portion, and then I will take the qualitative portion and do some integrated analysis as well.
So I'm curious, why did you decide to not use the telephone lab anymore? Because I know I've been to conferences where people still do, you know, those types of interviews or surveys.
Mm-hmm. Well, the request for telephone surveys really dropped off for us. And then it just also wasn't really that cost effective. They're very, very, very expensive. People don't really have budget for them. So we kind of decided to, just kind of relinquish the space and kind of drop that as a service. It's not to say that we can't do like very, very small telephone surveys now, but it's just something that we're not asked to do as much.
Yeah, and it seems like there's other ways to get that information. Like, I know a lot of people switch to social to get surveys done, or I'm guessing, you know, everyone's used to online.
Yeah, and people just aren't answering their phone.
Yeah, exactly.
So that makes it really hard.
You can see who's popping up now. So you're like, I don't know that number.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by Lumavero, developers of Invivo and other software designed by and for data experts to illuminate powerful new insights. You can find the 2024 Lumavero Early Career Researcher Grant application on the Lumavero website under Resources from March 14th to July 31st, 2024.
So, I mean, one thing I noticed too, reading through the studies, is they're diverse, and there's, you know, I find it interesting on how people find participants, because I think that's one of the harder things, right, when you're trying to do, especially qualitative research, because it's a lot of times very intensive with trying to find participants. So I was just curious, based on what you've seen in the different studies you've worked on, what are some things that stand out to you with that? Mm.
Yeah, I'll explain, I guess, how it's gone for me. And then Marla can touch on things, as Marla's mentioning, like over time, the tools we've used have changed. And, you know, to meet current demands and current circumstances, we just have had to adapt. And so, again, oftentimes the scope of population under study has been determined by the researcher already. So they generally have a eligibility criteria that they've determined. And depending on how far along their relationship is with the community or communities in the study, they might have a contact list already pre-made and developed where they have the names, phone numbers, emails of everyone that can potentially participate in the study. Then they give that to us and then we randomize it or keep groups segregated, heterogeneous or homogeneous, depending on what the needs of the study are. And then we reach out to folks with, you know, maybe a letter of invitation or a personalized email. I think, you know, that nuance of how personalized you need to get also often plays a role, because the populations that we tend to reach out to or need to speak with are heavily researched, over-researched. And so how do you come at that with a fresh invite that doesn't just look like spam or, you know, so even down to the subject line of an email, what I title that can either deter or attract someone to engage. But also we are, I think, lucky in that a lot of the work we do is very important, very prevalent, especially around healthcare needs of patients and whatnot. So when folks, you know, they already are engaged in the topic on a lot of the different studies, and then it's not that hard to persuade, so to speak, to get them to join. It's like as soon as you state the reason for the study they're in, depending again on the topic, right? So if they don't have a list, they may also contract contract us out to generate that list. So we might have to do a web scan or scope what's out there to build that list. So it obviously takes more time and costs a little more, but again, depending on what their needs are and how much time they have to do it. And then incentives is an interesting aspect of recruitment as well. I think when the surveys are more just opinion or attitude studies of the general public or the university student body, incentives tend to be a good way to draw folks in. But again, if folks are more engaged and it's about their health or their profession, their higher admin, their directors, then we don't usually, incentives aren't usually needed there because folks understand the importance of it and they just want the chance to have their voice heard. And that's a big part of it too, is stating your voice will be heard. Your perspectives and knowledge and experiences are important because at the end of the day, what else are we here for? So yeah, I might leave it at that, but basically finding innovative ways to personalize and convey meaning and tell them the implications of their engagement are what I try to impress upon them to get recruitment.
Yeah, I like that. Thanks.
And then for a lot of the things, like I said, I were doing a lot of program and process eval, just people who are participating in the programs, they're pretty willing to come up and talk to us. So they do reach out. They're always invited to reach out. Another thing that we've turned to is that over the past couple of years, we've been developing a community panel, which we do use for surveys, but also for qualitative recruitment. So everyone's consented to be, you know, contacted for any future studies. So our panel is about 6,500 Canadians right now. The bulk of that is Saskatchewan residents, but we're, you know, constantly growing that and trying to get a really representative Canadian panel that we can access. And yeah, like Rachel mentioned, that participant incentive does come into play quite a bit. And we do the participant payments. We can do, that's another service that we offer, is to handle that whole side, because I know that can be a bit of a nightmare as well. So I'll get them paid immediately and then they're happy. So
That's right. Like those are, I think, some of the things that, yeah, you have to think about, right? And I always find it fascinating how people get participants. So how do you work as a research team on the different studies? Because, you know, most of the studies did have multiple authors that I read. So what are some, I guess, some tips or things you find are helpful when working on a research team?
Yeah, this is a big question. And I feel like, again, the benefit and sort of the complexity of where we're situated in our positioning is that a team can look very different across projects. It could be two people. It could be, you know, I think back to the days of when we did have the telephone survey lab, and that's like 40 people working to get a study done. But I think in most cases for the studies I've worked on, it's been smaller teams, like five people or less. If there's team coding happening and you're having to establish, you know, inter-rater reliability and consensus and validation, that becomes a much more organized, structured process with like built-in team meetings and making sure people know what they're supposed to do, listing out expectations, what everyone's distinct role is, because sometimes people have more than one role too. And what do you need to be for this project in particular? I think every project benefits from having a team lead or, you know, project manager, so to speak. And that's one skill that I think as methodologists, we weren't necessarily all formally trained for, but it came with the position, just knowing how to carry a project through its life cycle, handling the administrative aspects. And again, it depends on your relationship with the client. If it's the first time you've worked with them, that sort of team dynamic might look a little different than a repeat client you've worked with since 2014. So, is it you can communicate over email? Is it better to have phone call? Like, it just really depends on, and now of course with qualitative analysis software, you can handle team efforts in one digital file, which is always fun and a challenge, but you know, to have, it's really about getting people on the same page. I find that's the challenge, even with the things we're researching, that's all it's about, is like, you know, what cuts across and what's common, and do we all have an agreed upon definition of what this concept is? And that's what you find when you run focus groups, is that people aren't thinking about things the same way. So I think a lot of underlying current is just like managing expectations and making sure people are on the same page and having everyone have that flexibility the need for flexibility is huge. I think the more players that are in the game on a project, mm-hmm. because things like funding or the timing of things, resources, someone might quit on the study. And then how do we fill that gap when we're training folks? Is it better to have them, you know, it's always ideal to have them a part of the study or project from the start so that they can build that relationship with the client from the get-go. So there's so many things that maybe you can't control too. And I think everyone has to kind of respect that and know what comes with research is that you kind of have to go with the waves to get it done on time, on budget, and ethically and rigorously and all that. So I think, yeah, that's a interesting question to try to answer. I hope I've answered it. If Marla has anything to add, maybe she can add something.
No, that was really good. For me, it's just critical to have like a point person to contact when, you know, things might be going beyond what we were quoting out initially, and or, you know, we have, or they keep having team members that are like requesting more and more, and there's a bit of a scope creep or anything like that. So just having like one point person to come back to and be like, let's work this out together in terms of next steps. And I find that that's always really helpful because we do work in small teams frequently. Usually, you know, we'll have the main researcher, maybe they have a small group of research assistants or grad students working with them and everything like that. So just kind of filtering through that. And it's just, it's a lot of emails. It's a lot of emails. It's a lot of impromptu meetings. It's a lot of scheduled meetings. But it all, I mean, 99.9% of our experiences are really positive. The frustrations just come as people aren't responding to like our calls for help.
So, yeah, I think.
But people are busy and that's why they need us. So
yeah, that's almost any time you're working with a team, people.
yeah. So I don't know if we have unique experiences with it. It's just, it is what it is, but it's, yeah.
I mean, some of the stuff you mentioned, yeah, I think is, you know, unique to research. Like I think the training part, like all that, when and making sure you're all on the same page going forward with the study, that does make sense. So I'm going to switch my questions now to ask you some questions about chapters you both wrote in a textbook called Varieties in Qualitative Research Methods, Selected Contextual Perspectives, published by Springer. So Marla, I'm going to start with you. You wrote a chapter on coding qualitative data. So, you know, what are some of the key takeaways that you wanted to make sure you had in that chapter for people?
Yeah, so prior to writing that chapter, I had just worked with a faculty member on campus here about preparing a guest lecture on how to code data for her graduate studies or for her graduate class. And when I was going through and developing it, it became so obvious that I had never had my hand held or directed on how to code data. It was such a leap in and hope for the best process. So it really was a chapter that I wanted to target towards, you know, undergrads, graduates who just are looking for some sort of coherent guidance on how to do this. So converted that presentation into this chapter. And I just really wanted to provide them with some like really clear steps, but also with all that flexibility in how to approach different kinds of data and different kinds of studies and everything like that. So the step-by-step to how to kind of get into your data, and then also just reminding them to focus on what are the objectives, what are your research questions you have to be able to code to answer those. It's always great to code other emergent topics that are kind of outside the scope of the study and kind of like parking lot those for later and see where you can go investigate later. But you do have to answer your research questions. And then within that chapter, I wanted to make sure that there was, you know, a chunk sample of text where people could see how I would have coded that if I was doing a thematic analysis on a first round coding, and to explain full well that you may have interpreted this different with qualitative data, the coding and the assigning of codes and the language that you use, like that is the precision. We don't get numbers. So to be so mindful and so careful, and how important it is to bracket all of those expectations and prejudices and biases, because you have to operate kind of as that filter on how people's words and feelings and everything gets interpreted. And if you're not mindful while you're doing your coding, like there's no wrong way to code, but you really just have to be mindful to, you know, remain true to your content. and, mm-hmm. and to your participants. So that's kind of where that chapter came from. And I kind of thrust it upon the editors. Like I remember Rachel got invited to contribute to it. And I was like, Hey, I just did this. Can I do this? And they're like, sure. So
nice. Well, I think it's neat that it came from a presentation.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then I like that term filter, like thinking, yeah, that, because yeah, you're right. That's yeah. There is a, like sort of a, art form sometimes.
Yeah, the art and science.
Yeah. Coding. Yeah. So thank you. And then Rachel, you wrote two chapters in the textbook, and one was on, and I just want to preface that you are an in vivo certified expert. So you know, you've gone through a course and, you know, took assessment. So you know the software pretty well. And so you wrote a chapter on harnessing insights with in vivo. So how can the use of in vivo sort of help qualitative researchers, you know, navigate those common challenges when using software? Because I think that was the main sort of point of the chapter, was to help people with that.
Yeah, the chapter was really about like, how can you use software to get the most out of your data? Like you've worked so hard to collect that data and it's important. And like Marla said, we need to honor it and we can't say things that weren't said in the data. But with what's there, I think a program like in vivo can help you run queries and explore the data in ways that you can't access just reading line by line. You can try and it might be possible, but it would take much longer. And you might not get the relationships and connections and patterns in the data that you can with a query that takes like 30 seconds to run. So, and I think it's a good preface and segue talking to Marla about the coding, because in qualitative research in general, it's so vast and so nebulous, and there's no recipe and perfect instruction and definition of how to code what. And that's a common question we get asked from folks is like, what am I doing here? How do I code? How do I turn this into a report? Can you give me an example? And we can't even really give examples because every project is different. And also there's confidentiality boundaries that we can't cross, right? So it's hard to show people how to do qualitative research. But in vivo, I think, is a good program that can links, you know, help you wade through that vastness of it and get some sort of clarity and make your research endeavor more manageable. And because it is also methodologically agnostic. So whether you're doing grounded theory, phenomenology, narrative inquiry, you can use the program and its features to further your research. So it helps by also digitalizing all processes that were formerly manual or done on paper that were probably seen in my timing of this. I've kind of always used it in vivo for projects that we've done. So I hardly have exposure to the manual way of doing things. So from where I stand, it's been really convenient to have everything in one simple file that you can then send to your prof or your supervisor, or your colleagues or your team. And it provides that sort of, it's almost like a pathway into your brain, because as we know in qual, how you got from A to B is as important as the results themselves. It's subjective, it's interpretive, it's that filter. So it also helps provide features that, like Marla said, sort of mitigate the bias, and there's opportunities for memos and annotations where you can reflect on the data as well as sift through it for the hard ends of it. And so whether you're doing individual or teamwork, it does provide that audit trail of what you've done. And it also allows for visuals that help break up the monotony of text upon text when you're writing your report. Like how many times have we done reports where it's just like, here are the themes, this is why they're related, this is why they're important. But if you can visualize some of that, especially the concepts that maybe were unexpected or are highly prevalent, or one population in your study talked about them, but another didn't. And what does that mean? If you can find ways to integrate that into your report, it makes it that much more compelling and meaningful to the reader than just, you know, here it is. And things like the crosstabs and matrices are, I think, particularly useful for folks that want to run investigations into whether there are similarities or differences in themes based on demographic data. So we find more people now are collecting that. I mean, they have to have collected it consistently for each participant for the query to be very helpful. But in cases where they have done that, we can certainly offer that as an additional reporting aspect. Like, do you want us to kind of see, were males, females, or those that identified as other gender saying the same thing on this? Were they saying different things? Mm-hmm. Years of experience often comes into play, you know, when we're talking to professionals or folks that have been in their field for a long time. So to sort of summarize, it helps you really see and explore your data in ways that you, I think, are just far less accessible and convenient when you're reading line by line. And then, you know, to have it all in a nice digital bounded file makes it easy for project management, team management, mm-hmm. those more pragmatic elements of the research as well. So it helps with both sort of the pragmatic and the actual research exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. My advisor always said it makes qualitative research much more transparent to people and yourself and whoever you're working with, because you're always generally working with someone and need to show it. So thank you.
We'll take a quick break from the episode to learn more about the work conducted at the Canadian Hub for Applied and Social Research at the University of Saskatchewan. Please visit their website at chasr.usask.ca/index.php.
And then your other chapter was on transcribing qualitative data, which is not always, well, I guess it's getting a little easier with software now in some ways, but people still, that is a lot of times part of their analysis process too, is doing the transcribing. So if you want to sort of maybe talk about some recommendations around what you think is good with transcribing.
Yeah. No, I was talking to Marla about this prior to the interview, because I have to be careful here. Like, my own personal opinion about transcription is becoming outdated, I suppose, if you will. Like, ideally, for me, it's a manual and human-led endeavor. Because like you said, sometimes even at the point of transcription and data translation, you are analyzing your data. So my recommendation, be it unorthodox, is that transcription should be a human-led enterprise. Machine and technology can aid for sure, but through the use of transcription software like Express Scribe or Footpedals. But I do believe that the primary listener and voice-to-text translator should be a human, particularly if we're doing social research, like if we're wanting to discover things about humans and not only what they say and the substantive content, but also how they say things has so much more importance in the meaning. So there's so many facets to interview data, and I think transcription tends to get oversimplified, you know, into a type what you hear task. But then, of course, once people come to us asking for help with transcription, it's because they realize it can actually be quite challenging. It can be strenuous. But to make data truly what we call analysis ready, you have to ensure not only what is said, but how it's said, captured in that digital format. So, and several things can make this more or less difficult, including, you know, paraverbal features like pitch, tone, the pace, the volume at which people speak, the context or study specific features like accents, the discipline or topic specific jargon that they're using, acronyms. And the setting, you know, there's also physical constraints that come with field data in general. For example, wind in the background or clanking dishes or multiple speakers, all these fun things that can make it an added challenge. So, and the English language also requires picking up on context to decipher between, you know, homonyms or words that sound the same, but are spelled differently, like there, and there, two and two. We've had some laughs over the years as to the many transcription errors that have occurred. You know, someone wrote stakeholder and they put S-T-E-A-K. So, you know, that's why I say, again, I advocate for that human element always as a qualitative researcher. But I do understand that, you know, as we move on and voice to text or AI becomes stronger and more accurate, there is a place for it in transcription. And I will let Marla speak to that.
Yeah, so I do want to acknowledge, you know, Rachel's approach to transcription, because she was actually a transcriber on my first qualitative project. And the difference between doing analysis on the quality output that she used to provide, and, you know, when transcribing or in charge of our transcribers, there was a big difference, because they were consistently capturing laughs and pitch and sarcastic tones and everything like that. So I do miss that. And I say miss that because we've recently transitioned our transcription model here at Chaser to AI-supported transcription. It's not without quality review, though. We don't just run an audio through this through the program and send it back. There are still we do have transcribers still. They were transcribers, manual transcribers, and now they're quality review staff who go through the audio line by line to ensure that, you know, the things that it does not pick up get put back in, and just to double check things like accuracy and words like that. But, you know, even with those extra steps, like Rachel was an artist when she used to transcribe. It was so beautiful. And it's really hard to get people trained up to that level. And the reason we moved away from manual transcription is just because it was, you know, not cost effective for us, and that it was very, very time consuming, and it deserves to be time consuming, but it doesn't work for the high frequency outputs that we have to do. So we're doing our best to make sure that we have a quality transcript that's analysis ready to go out now, but it's not like the days of old. But yeah, we're doing the best we can.
You're giving up something, but getting something. And it sounds like a good compromise to have the quality.
Quality review process.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense in doing that. So my last question is to both of you. What is one piece of advice you would give researchers interested in working at a research hub like you do?
Okay, so if they're going to work with us, there's kind of one consideration. So we are housed within the University of Saskatchewan. We are University of Saskatchewan employees. So we still are married to our research ethics board. So, you know, if we do have external clients who are coming to us, if there's any human participant interaction, data collection, so on and so forth, we do have to go through some sort of ethical review with the board. So that could be an exemption, which is, you know, a lot of program evaluation is exempt, but a lot of the times it's a full review. We're never above minimal risk, but it does take time, like at best 4 weeks, at worst 10. And so that does kind of affect the way that we can turn projects around. And I think that a lot of external clients like had not considered this at all. They're like, we have 3 weeks, let's go. And it's like, well, no, you can do it in 3 weeks. We can't. So there's definitely that. And then also anyone approaching us who might be new to qual needs to have an appreciation that it is a very time-consuming process. We don't turn to AI for any of our analysis. It is still human-led and therefore takes a lot of time. So be flexible with your timelines, please.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to echo some of what Marla said and also cheat a bit and say three things. Outlining your resources and knowing your resources, your budget, your timeline are very important, because that dictates at the end of the day how far we can go with it and what our role should maybe be, where we're of best value for the client. So giving yourself a realistic timeline, as Marla said, because oftentimes people come to us very last minute and then it becomes hard on us. Like, we want to provide quality outputs, but that can't necessarily be sacrificed for efficiency in qualitative work. So my other piece of advice would be reflexive, own your biases, and seek ways to mitigate those throughout your study. Many folks don't realize how their interviewing style or as a researcher so vested in the topic can influence the participation of their respondents. So be humbled by your research and learn from your research, because it has things to teach you as well. And your research questions are your anchor. So for anyone kind of wandering through that abyss of what qual analysis is, that's my advice, is like, let your research questions always be your guide and rule of thumb as to how to best approach your population, how to recruit, how to best gather data and treat it once collected. Because I think part of good research is a strong output, whether that's another question or a finding or a paper, but it's also how we treat people in the process. We want them to have a good experience because we need people to do this research. So make it of utility, because a lot of folks don't just want lip service and for their words to end up on a shelf gathering dust. So, you know, theoretical and adding to a base of knowledge is great, but actionable research also leaves people feeling, I think, a little more hopeful So I think those would be my main, there's so many, you know, over 12 years, you gather a lot of pieces of advice for folks, but I'll strap it down to those three.
That could be your next book.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, thank you, Marla and Rachel, for talking with us. And thanks to those tuning in. Listeners, if you learn more about qualitative analysis processes, we'd appreciate your support by rating and subscribing to the In Vivo podcast. This helps us to share these amazing narratives with the research community. So thank you both.
Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, Stacey.
Thank you for joining us for Between the Data. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more about In Vivo podcasts and community events, please visit go.invivobyqsr.com/community or email me, Stacey Penna, at s.penna, P-E-N-N-A, at qsrinternational.com.